Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio in South Florida. In the past week and a half, two of Florida's largest counties and two of the counties hit hardest by the opioid crisis have started a process that could wind up in court with the counties suing opioid drug makers. This week, Broward County took the step. Last week, it was Palm Beach County. Both are interviewing law firms for a possible lawsuit.
The dismantling of families, the death and destruction, and if someone knew about this, they should pay more than dearly. They should pay financially. They should pay criminally.
That was Broward County Commissioner Chip LaMarca on Tuesday of this week. Now, the opioid epidemic has taken thousands of lives here in South Florida. It's costing millions of dollars, money spent on rescue and recovery efforts. What role do you feel pharmaceutical companies have played in that cost? Do the companies bear responsibility for these costs? And if so, how much? And the bigger question, how has your community been touched by the opioid epidemic? That's where we begin the Florida Roundup this week. You can join our conversation throughout the region, 800-743-WLRN. From Key West up to the Palm Beaches, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet, at WLRN is our handle. Dan Sweeney, reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, joins us via Skype. Peter Hayden, WLRN's Palm Beach reporter, and Pat Beal, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post, join us from studios in Boynton Beach. To all of you, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Pat Beal, let me start with you. What claims would the counties make if they actually file a lawsuit?
Well, without being an attorney and knowing specifically what they might file over, I think for pharma and the distributors alike, there's an old political question here, which is, what did they know and when did they know it? And there's plenty of evidence to suggest they knew a lot, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that they ignored a lot. And there was a 2007 settlement with Purdue Pharma and the Department of Justice, and that actually involved criminal charges. There was a money settlement, and it was just one federal district in Virginia. But, I spoke to Purdue Pharma not too long ago, and they said, well, you know, that kind of marketing that might have led to the inappropriate overprescription of our, of our OxyContin. That was then, and this is now. And since Purdue Pharma is one of the companies that has consistently been named in now, I think, more than 100 lawsuits or so, I would wonder if they would be looking at, well, you know, what have they done since 2007 that might be actionable? And I think it'll be interesting to see exactly what kinds of claims, they would be looking at, whether civil or criminal.
So Dan,
at some point.
Dan Sweeney with the Sun Sentinel, you heard Commissioner LaMarca mention pay financially and pay criminally. What do Broward commissioners want if they file a lawsuit?
Well, it's probably the same as the lawsuit being proposed in Palm Beach County as well. Basically, it would look a lot like the old tobacco lawsuits from back in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. There's a state law that says if a company harms residents through its product and knew that product was harmful, then they can be sued to recoup the costs of treating those people. So, obviously there were big wins against tobacco regarding that law, and these drug companies would be sued under the same principle.
So, Peter Hayden, what do we know about those costs of response and recovery in Palm Beach and Broward counties?
Well, Tom, we haven't gotten a lot of numbers, hard numbers, put out by the counties themselves. But I'll give you this example: Palm Beach County Fire Rescue responded to more than 4,500 overdose calls in 2016, just last year, in 2016. The Palm Beach County Fire Rescue Department estimates that they spend at least $1,500 on each of those calls. So you're looking right there, just in 2016, at more than $6 million spent by the county, by the taxpayers, for overdose calls. And to give you some other harder numbers, actually, I'm going to toss to my peer here, Pat Beal, who crunched some numbers on healthcare a while back for the Palm Beach Post.
Right. Well, we looked at hospital cost, and basically, you know, it looked like millions of dollars a day in hospital cost related to opioid overdoses and also illnesses that are directly related to injection drugs. And the costs were extraordinary, but what was also extraordinary is that Medicaid was picking up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in those costs. Mm. So if you want to look at, you know, state interests, that's one way to gauge state interests. They definitely have a dog in this hunt.
The Medicaid portion is a key piece because while those are federal funds that are kind of funneled through the state hands those out, so to speak. The state is the responsible agency in that, Pat. So where is the state of Florida and the AG's office, Pam Bondi, in regards to opioid manufacturers? Other states, I think Missouri, for instance, has talked about suing these drug makers.
Well, you know, Bondi is part of a working group of state's attorneys who are looking at the issue, and they've subpoenaed, you know, information. Mm-hmm. So you could say that they might be laying groundwork, but, you know, nothing formal yet.
We are talking about the opioid crisis this week here as we begin the Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can join the conversation, 800-743-9576. Two of the largest counties in the state of Florida have begun investigating and exploring the possibility of filing lawsuits against opioid drug manufacturers, the pharmaceutical companies involved in the prescription medicine here. Join the conversation, 800-743-9576. How has your community been touched by opioids? That was one of the questions we put out to our Ground Source Network. WLRN's engagement editor Katie Lepre joins us here on the Roundup. Katie, what did we hear back from our Ground Source Network?
Hi, Tom. So Ed P. in Lauderdale said that he hasn't personally seen any direct effects. However, he was on a medication that he had been taking routinely for years that he said has apparently become subject to abuse and as a result was reclassified. Now that means limited refills and much more scrutiny. Pat C. in Boynton Beach says she doesn't think the doctors who prescribe the medicine are to blame. She says the people who get these meds abuse them to begin with. Directly, the direct quote is, look to the patients, first then the doctors who are not monitoring the patient's progress. Mm. Jude A. in Delray Beach, who is a resident and small business owner in the heart of the city, says she is directly impacted by this epidemic. The press coverages, the stress on the community leaders, and the cost of finding a possible solution as well. We are in it together, and I believe it will take an honest effort to solve it.
That comment from Delray Beach, Pat Beal with the Palm Beach Post. Delray Beach has said, I believe that it plans on filing a lawsuit before the end of this calendar year. Is that right?
Yes. And Delray Beach, of course, has been the epicenter of Palm Beach County's problem, which has been at the epicenter of Florida. And Florida is at the epicenter of the United States. I would like to jump in, though, and respond to an issue that was raised by one of the listeners, and that's patients' responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there is a number out there, and it's a very good number, and it's 1 in 49. And that 1 in 49 is the number of people who are prescribed opioids, high dosage opioids, say post-surgically, it really doesn't matter what it's for, who are still going to be on opioids a year later, which is indicative of addiction. Mm-hmm. The fact is, these are highly, highly addictive drugs, and doctors were prescribing them for a very long time, believing that they weren't addictive. Patients were taking them for a very long time for everything from back pain to sprained ankles, also thinking that they weren't addictive. There are accidental addicts out there, and quite a few of them.
Dan Sweeney, what are the lessons in this opioid epidemic and the potential legal responses that these government agencies are exploring? The lessons from the pill mill crackdown of a decade ago.
Well, you know, the pill mill crackdown took a statewide effort, and state laws were passed to kind of provide a blanket regulation across the state. It's different here where you're seeing, you know, individual counties filing lawsuit to try to address the problem, which, you know, tells you that despite the fact that Pam Bondi is involved in this multi-state talks with other state attorney generals, that a lot of the counties here are you have to assume are thinking that, you know, this is just not moving along quickly enough.
800-743-9576 is the telephone number, the opioid epidemic. Some action beginning to be taken on the part of two counties in South Florida, at least investigating the potential of lawsuits against these pharmaceutical manufacturers. We will begin in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale. Vicki has been hanging on the line. Vicki, you're on the radio. Thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I wanted to say I would agree strongly that the cities, the counties, the state go after a third-party liability responsibility from these big pharma. But as a recovering person, I wanted to say that I see this every day in the rooms. I am a strong believer that big pharma has gone a long way to causing this overabundance of rehab, insurance fraud, the number of people that are pulled down here into Florida. Somebody mentioned Delray Beach earlier. It's insane the amount of people that are addicted to these, and I'm very careful not to allow them to be prescribed to me because I am in recovery. But I think controlling the amount of pills that are allowed to go out would go a long way into resolving some of these other issues.
Vicki, we got it. Thanks for sharing your experiences with us and with the WLRN listeners. We appreciate it. Vicki mentions folks that come to South Florida for recovery. Peter Hayden, I know that you've explored some of these recovery homes, this recovery tourism, so to speak. This imports the cost of recovery into South Florida in a way that other communities may not experience, doesn't it?
Certainly. As Pat mentioned, for a long time, Palm Beach County has been looked at as kind of a mecca for drug treatment and addiction therapy. And so over the past two decades, at least, there have been a lot of people in recovery from drug substance use disorder coming and concentrating themselves in South Florida. And a high percentage of people in opioid recovery relapse. It hovers somewhere around 80%. And so, you know, when you get a lot of people clustering in a small area, you're going to have a lot of relapses. It's going to result in a lot of 911 calls and folks going to emergency rooms and being helped by other public services. And that's certainly what we're seeing.
What has been some of the response of the legitimate operators in the recovery business?
Well, they're very concerned. I mean, the biggest, Tom, flag bearers of the effort to root out corruption within the recovery community are the good providers, the people who are legitimately trying to get people off of these drugs and keep them clean and have them lead a purpose-filled life. They are really, and they're the ones that really get a black eye from the media coverage of the corruption that goes on in the recovery industry. So they're out front. They want, they certainly want the corruption cleaned up.
Talking about the opioid epidemic, two counties exploring the potential of legal action against pharmaceutical companies. You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, 800-743-9576. That was Peter Hayden of WLRN's Palm Beach Bureau. We're also joined by Pat Beal, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post, Dan Sweeney, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and WLRN's engagement editor Katie Lepre is also along with us. Let's go back to your phone calls in West Palm. Michelle is on the radio. Michelle, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts on this?
Well, thank you. I'm just talking as a caretaker for my family, both for my mom, who got bladder cancer, and she was put on various drugs, but overdosing type drugs, that to the point that my brother and I had to write a letter and say back off. And she actually had to detox herself. It was very sad. And then secondly, same thing with my brother, who was a disabled veteran, and he was overdone with what they were giving him. And last but not least, the girlfriend of my brother, fiance, they put her on 28 different meds. She's 65. And I complained and complained and complained, and nobody's listening because it was being prescribed. And they are now presently supposed to be detoxing her. So the elderly and the compromised system people, including our parents, including anybody that's had a severe crisis, health crisis, are being OD'd on these drugs, and there's no watchdog. And I've complained to ACA, and I keep beating the drum.
ACA, the healthcare agency here in the state of Florida.
To tell them, need to look at it. I mean, 28 pills a day, my brother's girlfriend, and some of them multiple. It was like, I compared it to the center I just got her out of. I compared it to Stephen King could write his next movie by just going to check out and watching all the zombies walking around.
We hope for you and your family it would be a happy ending if that story plays itself out. Michelle, thank you for sharing your experiences and your family's experiences with us here on the Florida Roundup. Pat Beal, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the watchdog, the regulatory role in the state. The opioids that we're talking about here, the opioids that the county governments are thinking about suing over, are opioids that are federally regulated, that are highly regulated. These are prescription meds that live and breathe inside a highly regulated environment. These are not street drugs that they're suing these pharmaceutical companies over.
Not so regulated, not really. I mean, that was part of the. Well, you know, there's been plenty of criticism that the Food and Drug Administration, when it first approved OxyContin, which is pure oxycodone, which is a chemical cousin to heroin, that they really did not look at it carefully, and that they were playing catch up when the problem started emerging. There was criticism of the DEA and whether it was aggressively looking into oxycodone and OxyContin before the pill mills. And there was also criticism of the state of Florida that it was so late in instituting a prescription drug monitoring program. And by the time it did, it was almost as though the damage was done. And I want to go back to something our caller just said about veterans and the elderly. Mm-hmm. Purdue Pharma specifically targeted veterans and the elderly, even though veterans are much more likely to commit suicide if they are using opioids. And also, there are a host of problems in terms of prescribing these for the elderly. And I'm going to share a story. My 94-year-old mother was in the hospital, and she had some muscle pain, nothing large. She asked the nurse for two Tylenol. They brought her two Percocet. So we have this entire culture now that even though, yes, these are very dangerous opioids, sometimes they're being given out without much thought.
And in the case of your mom, we're not going to read too much into the intention, but one of the questions I would imagine an investigative reporter like yourself, Pat, would ask is what education or training does the nursing staff have to go from a patient request of Tylenol to an over-the-counter hospital delivery of Percocet?
Well, I don't know exactly the level of training. I think the initial thought would be not enough. But I want to point out, too, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid actually grade hospitals and, to a lesser degree, physicians on whether the patient is satisfied with their care. There's a questionnaire, and one or two of those questions was, were you put out of pain?
Right.
And the fact is, you know, I mean, they can get dinged financially if they do not aggressively treat pain.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Pain has become a disease in many cases, not simply a symptom of a disease. The Florida Roundup here on WLRN, the opioid epidemic, two counties taking the step toward investigating lawsuits against pharmaceutical manufacturers. We're talking about it here, talking about it also with our Ground Source Network, which is a network of folks throughout South Florida who talk to us via text messages. Our engagement editor, Katie Lepre, helps moderate those conversations. What else have we heard on the Ground Source Network?
So Jackie H. in Hollywood says that in her personal life at home, she doesn't really see the impact. Quote, because I'm not from Florida, and the only person I'm actually close to is my husband and a couple of friends, none of which do drugs or alcohol of any type. But at my job, it's a different story. I work for a major airline, and I see erratic behavior that's not within the guidelines of what my company wants. Sharon L. in Delray Beach says, some of the burden is in the hands of the person who's taking the drug. I see villainizing the drug companies is an opportunity to raid the till.
We've heard that sentiment certainly expressed on Ground Source. We've heard quite the opposite also expressed on the telephone line. 800-743-9576. Dan Sweeney with the South Florida Sun Sentinel via Skype. What about the role of Florida? The governor did declare a state of emergency for opioids earlier this year. What has happened since then?
Well, that freed up some tens of millions of federal dollars to be used, most of which is being used to supply first responders with drugs to revive people who have overdosed. Narcan, for example. Mm-hmm. And then also some of that money goes toward treatment. But the amount of beds in treatment facilities doesn't come anywhere near the amount of actual addicts who need treatment and who are required to get treatment if they're, you know, caught in possession and, or that sort of thing. So the amount of money that going into to supply beds to treat addiction is not nearly enough. And the state laws meant to address the opioid crisis that we're looking at in the upcoming legislative session are really just about, you know, limiting the amount of initial opioids that can be prescribed, not necessarily about, you know, treatment after the effect.
Yeah. Meantime, first responders are literally on the front lines of this epidemic. And Peter Hayden, you have ridden along with some of those first responders. What are they experiencing? What are those experiences like?
Well, they're they're overwhelmed by and large in many jurisdictions here in South Florida. They'll be sent out on many times multiple calls during a shift, multiple overdose calls. They arrive at the scene. Oftentimes they revive the individual with Narcan. And what they're seeing more and more, Tom, as I've learned over the past couple years, as the synthetic opioids, the very strong fentanyl and fentanyl analogs have come in and started to be cut into the street drug market, they're having to use more and more naloxone or Narcan. This is the overdose reversal drug to revive the overdose victim. So that's another expense that they're experiencing. They're having to pump a lot of naloxone into these individuals, revive them, and in some cases, they give them a ride to the hospital. They're treated. They may be out, and they may end up reviving that same person later in the day. It's happened.
Pat Beal, do we need to make a distinction here between the prescription drug portion of this epidemic and the street drug portion of this epidemic, or is that a distinction without a difference ultimately?
Well, I don't think that users who've transitioned from one to the other find a major distinction. I mean, both of them are derived from the poppy plant, which is a source of opium and morphine. You could argue that the prescription drugs, and in particular oxycodone, which is derived from the poppy plant, is a semi-synthetic, and heroin, is purer than that. But the high is just the same. They're literally the molecular structure is almost identical. And in terms of making that distinction, I think the distinction is only helpful if the discussion is about the responsibility of regulators, pharmaceutical companies, distributors, ultimately, and doctors, to deal with how they prescribe.
One more phone call here in Hollywood. Andrea has been holding on. Andrea,
hi.
You're on the radio. Thanks for holding.
That's okay. I'm kind of on the opposite end of this argument. I had a major back surgery 4 years ago, which resulted in some major nerve damage and some other things. And I'm on, I take opioids every day of my life. And it has made it harder and harder for me to get the medication that I need simply to function in society as a functional human being without tremendous amounts of pain. I see an anesthesiologist every month. I have to go through drug tests. I have to do all of these things. And people like myself who are serious chronic pain patients are being hurt by this discussion.
Andrea, how are you being hurt by the discussion? Are you seeing your
access
limited?
Because suddenly I have to be drug tested. Yes, my access is limited. My drugs are now, I have to be drug tested every 6 months or so. I have to see my doctor every month instead of every other month or every 3 months. I can only get a certain number of pills per month and et cetera, et cetera. And it seems arbitrary.
Andrea, we appreciate the perspective. We hope you're on the mend there from that surgery. Andrea from Hollywood with that perspective. Pat, Peter, Dan, the thoughts kind of on this other side of legitimate uses of these medicines.
Well, I think it's really sad in a way, because would we have all of these restrictions for legitimate pain patients if, in fact, the DEA and the FDA and state regulators and doctors and pharmaceutical companies had been more responsible to begin with? Instead, you know, we have this raging problem with opioids, and in fact, legitimate pain patients are caught up in this.
Paying the price for it. Pat Beal, investigative reporter for the Palm Beach Post. She's along with us with WLRN's Palm Beach reporter Peter Hayden. Thanks to both of you for joining us from Boynton Beach. Dan Sweeney with us via Skype, a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Kitty Lepre, our engagement editor here at WLRN. To the quartet, thanks so much for joining us here on the Roundup. Lots more to come. Two public hospital leaders in Broward County are accused of meeting in private, just the latest scandal at Broward Health. Your thoughts on Broward Health and the scandal. 800-743-WLRN after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. A year ago this month, the board that governs Broward Health System fired its CEO. This week, a grand jury indicted five people, accusing them of violating the state's open meeting law. Two of those facing charges remain on the board. Two are part of the executive team as well. This is just the latest problem for the public health district that has included a big health care fraud settlement, allegations of sweetheart contracts, and potentially big legal bills for taxpayers. So, Broward Health System and its scandals, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also join us on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. Katie Swietolski is WLRN's Broward County reporter, and Dan Christensen is editor of the nonprofit Florida Bulldog. To both of you, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Great to have you. Katie, first of all, what are these five people indicted with?
Well, thank you, Tom. So, we've got charges. They're all second-degree misdemeanors, but they're charges of conspiracy for violating the open meetings law, suspicion of violating open meetings law, and of just violating the open meetings law. So basically, those are all varying degrees of the same charge.
Which is what?
A grand jury has investigated, and they believe that this was deliberate. This was not an accidental, we forgot to post that we were having a meeting, that this was premeditated and sort of, you know, a secret planned way to do this without anyone knowing.
This wasn't five people caught in an elevator before an open meeting. This was something more, they think.
Well, and this was a series of individual meetings right before the firing of the then interim CEO, Pauline Grant. And they were, you know, individual meetings between board members and outside attorneys.
So, Dan, take us back a year ago, December 1st, when the Broward Health System board meeting happened and it fired its then CEO. What happened?
Well, they had a meeting that was a hurried meeting. It's been alleged that there wasn't sufficient notice given to the public of the meeting. And they came in, they heard a report, supposedly by a couple of independent, two independent law firms, one that did the investigation, one that did an evaluation of the investigation and mm-hmm. recommended that she be fired because of alleged kickbacks that she
What sparked that investigation initially that led to the board meeting that led to the
firing? Well,
there
was a complaint apparently from a physician who claimed that he had been excluded from being on a on an orthopedic wheel, I mm-hmm. guess you might call it,
yeah.
To provide services at the hospital.
A roster of sorts.
Yes, yeah. And he contended that he had been illegally excluded by her and that she was basically demanding that he bring in more patients in order to get on the list.
So this investigation was launched by the board.
The investigation was launched by the general counsel. Pretty much in secret. General Counsel Lynn Barrett, who's one of the ones who's been indicted.
Right.
Yeah, there were four commissioners and the general counsel who were indicted. The commissioners are Christopher Urey, Beverly Capasso, who has since become the CEO of the of Broward Health.
Right.
Chairman Rocky
Rodriguez.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Linda Robeson, who was on the commission until this month when she was replaced by Governor Scott.
So, Katie, how serious are these charges?
Well, they're serious because they're criminal, but they're a little unusual for violating the Sunshine Law because usually there's just a civil lawsuit brought against the agency. But criminal charges mean, you know, it's actually against these individuals, not the agency. So, you know, what happens now is sort of yet to be seen because there's so many on this board at one time.
But the criminal charges mean that they could, you know, each face a fine of up to $500 and serve up to 60 days in jail.
Hmm. So maybe not a high fine, but certainly time behind bars. And Dan, of the five indicted, four are still with the health system.
Well, yes. Lynn Barrett, who remains general counsel, and Yuri Rodriguez and Beverly Capasso.
Right. And so their status with the health system.
Well, the status at the moment is they're there and they're working. The question now is the governor going to take action here? There's a couple of things that he can do when you take a look at the law. There's a statute that deals directly with this. But these are his own appointees.
Right.
And it would be somewhat of a major embarrassment if he has to turn around and pull them. So it won't reflect very well on him. However, there's a board meeting coming up next week.
Are they going to have a quorum?
Well, I mean, if you have the indicted people there, they'll have a quorum. They haven't been removed yet. Are we going to have people sitting on that board making decisions who are under indictment?
What's at stake for the Broward County taxpayers here?
Well,
this
is a
billion-dollar enterprise in revenue,
I mean,
right? Plus the health care of, the two-thirds northern portion of Broward County?
Well, I think it's the two-thirds. It's right around Stateroute 84 north.
Yeah.
Anyway, I live in the northern part of the county. I pay those taxes and others, and it's a substantial chunk, several hundred dollars every year, and it adds up to about $150 million a year. So that's a lot of money here that taxpayers are funding, and it seems to me they deserve to get, you know, good government at a minimum out of this.
Katie, how is this playing with other kind of government agencies, the county and others here who may not be directly involved, but this is a governance question, this is a management question, but ultimately it's taxpayer dollars that are at stake here.
Yeah, and I was talking with Frank Lamonte. He's the director of the Breckner Center for Freedom of Information, and he was telling me, you know, I thought he put it really well. He said, look, even if you're the kind of person that never sees yourself going to a public board meeting for Broward Health, if you pay taxes, you should care that someone else has the right to go watch over your money. Because that's what it is. It's your money. And, you know, with five huge public hospitals, if you get sick or your neighbor gets sick, you know,
and
you're going to be treated there.
If I might chime in, a lot of the money these days is going to pay for lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
They've all lawyered up. Broward Health is footing the bill. We just had another one add. We've had several more add on that I've seen. I did a story a couple of years ago about how they had paid a couple of law firms $3 million to do, you know, thus and such, outside law firms,
mm-hmm.
in addition to the staff of people that they have working.
The legal counsel inside. Yeah,
yeah. It's like a feeding frenzy.
Well, you know, walk us through, if you could, Dan. You've been covering this with the Florida Bulldog for a good number of years with the Broward Health System. It has been mired in controversy upon controversy. Healthcare fraud and a $70 million settlement while not acknowledging or admitting to any guilt, but a significant pay to get fraud charges moved along. All of the questions and investigations around whistleblower lawsuits and sweetheart contracts and marketing contracts and radiation contracts.
We could sit here all afternoon.
What's at the heart of the what's the common thread, if there is one, as you've covered this through the years?
The common thread is the governor. He's the one who appoints everybody. He's the one that controls what's going on. And frankly, he is involved in some of the deals there, at least one that we know of. There was a $25 million deal a few years ago.
Meaning his investment firm, his family investment firm.
No, he was an investor in a private equity firm that had an interest in a company called 21st Century Oncology, mm-hmm. which is currently in Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. They're based over in Naples. A few years back, they got a 25-year, no-bid contract to provide exclusive radiation oncology services at Broward Health,
yeah.
and all its facilities. It's been estimated that that's worth, over the term of it, be worth like $2.5 billion. What Broward Health is getting back for that seems to be minimal from what I can tell. But the bottom line here is that the governor was involved in this, and yet he's the one who's appointing these commissioners. And now you have a second case, a whistleblower case,
mm-hmm.
that was filed a few months ago by the former chairman of Broward Health, a guy named David DiPietro.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about you know, it makes these explosive allegations about the governor's friend, a guy named Bill Rubin, who's a lobbyist. He was a lobbyist for 21st Century Oncology. And he, according to the whistleblower lawsuit, went in, got the former CEO, a guy named Frank Nask, you know, told him that he could keep his job if he, you know, pushed this through, and it got pushed through. And the guy apparently has bragged about the fact that he is, you know, the guy who decides who the governor is going to appoint there. It's all quite scary.
Some of these, at least one of the accusations that led to the health care fraud settlement predated Governor Scott, though, as governor,
yes.
Certainly. That whistleblower case, there were accusations
there
going back to 2001.
Yes. Well, I mean, for years, for decades, there have been problems and there's been suspicions and stuff. But, the stuff that led to which was also another whistleblower case, which a local doctor filed and said that they'd basically been cheating on Medicare,
right,
and Medicaid. And
right,
it ultimately led to this decision, which was, it cost them $70 million.
Katie Swietlowski, as the residents of Broward County and the taxpayers of Broward County move forward, how should they? Well, what's been the response from these folks that have been indicted on violating the open meeting law?
Well, they have not openly come out with statements, but their lawyers have come out with statements. And the general counsel for all of Broward Health, Bob Butterworth, his statement is he's furious. He thinks this is, you know, a very biased investigation. He calls the prosecution wrong. So he's very clear that this is not something that will move forward. But I think it's also important to see that, you know, on a national level, people who run hospitals across the country are watching what's going to happen with this, because, you know, how hospitals get run in other cities across the country are going to have to change if these officials are, you know.
Florida is pretty consistently held up as a state with model open meeting laws and sunshine
exactly.
laws. You know this. Dan knows this considerably. And anybody working in the media knows this, or anybody interested in how government works knows these kinds of things. So how rare is it for not only to bring a prosecution of an open meeting law, but to go to a grand jury to convince a grand jury to hand down indictments?
Multiple indictments. It's extremely rare.
Yeah, it's not unprecedented, but I mean,
I don't know of any other example where they've basically indicted not the entire board, because there are some other people on there now that weren't there at the time. But I mean, to take down five people like this, I've not seen it down here.
It's very rare. And, you know, it's so much easier for the state to just side with the agency. I mean, what you usually see is the state just sort of, you know, not blows this off, but sides with the agency, whether they're right or wrong.
Kind of delegates the decision to the agency that was responsible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so to have this go before a grand jury is, you know, the last big case of this was in the 1970s. It's not common at all.
And to be clear, Dan and Katie, who is on the prosecutorial side here? Is this the state of Florida making these accusations?
Yeah, this is the Mike Satz, the state attorney of
Broward County. Broward County, bringing it on behalf of the people.
Yeah, Tim Donnelly was the guy who actually presented the case.
Yeah.
I was there when they began this, you know, calling witnesses back in September. And it looked serious then. And it was surprising. It was shocking that this came down, not only for the way it happened, but also for the fact that the state attorney's office is not known for being aggressive on what amounts to public corruption. But boy, they're aggressive on this one.
Has the open meeting notice been filed for the next board meeting for Broward Health?
I don't know. yes, I guess it has, because I saw it.
Okay, must have. Dan Christensen, editor for the nonprofit The Florida Bulldog. You always do great work, Dan, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Katie Swietlowski covering Broward County for us here at WLR. And Katie, great to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Stay close. We've got more to come here on the Roundup. We're going to be talking about Major League Soccer. Is South Florida any closer to getting an MLS team here in South Florida? That's still to come. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to join the conversation. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
So I'm thrilled to announce that David Beckham has exercised his option to purchase an MLS expansion team, and so excited that he selected Miami as the market for his new club.
That was February, 4 years ago almost, when Major League Soccer Commissioner Don Garber stood on stage with soccer legend David Beckham, with Biscayne Bay as the backdrop, and said a new MLS soccer team would be coming to Miami.
You know, players are already interested in coming to Miami. Who wouldn't want to live in Miami and to play in Miami?
Well, but there's no Major League Soccer team yet for players or for fans yet. Still, this week, Major League Soccer did approve changes to the ownership group trying to make Beckham's pledge a reality. The new menu includes brothers who came up short in their effort to buy the Miami Marlins baseball team just a few months ago. So, Major League Soccer, any close to becoming a reality here? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. The stadium, the team, the tickets, the investment. What's happening? You can send us a tweet at WLRN. Doug Hanks is along with us. He covers Miami-Dade County for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Doug, I was doing the math on this. Yeah, it was February of 2014 when Beckham and Garber and Mayor Carlos Jimenez of Miami-Dade County stood up on that podium and talked glowingly about bringing Major League Soccer. Since then, I think by my count, the stadium has had, what, three different locations at least?
Right. This is the fourth.
This is the fourth location. We'll talk about all that in a moment, but it was just yesterday where Major League Soccer owners okayed this change in the lineup of the investors for Beckham. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a very troubled stadium bid. I don't know if it's the most troubled or the most extended in professional sports, but they keep losing main investors. You know, David Beckham is not the main investor.
Right.
And it was going to be the co-owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who they announced a great fanfare last spring, Todd Boehly. And then all of a sudden, I guess it was last week, was it Todd Boehly was gone.
He was out from the Miami bid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Beckham is the figurehead. He's the name, but he's not the one with the most money in it.
Well, and that seems to be a point of contention because he's more than the figurehead. When Beckham came to Major League Soccer 10 years ago to play, at a time when most people didn't really know what Major League Soccer was, right, part of his contract said, not only are we going to pay you a lot of money to play for us, but we'll give you a franchise, an expansion franchise, at a fixed price, which was $25 million. 10 years later, these teams are selling for $150 million, and that's money just goes straight into the owner's pockets.
Yeah, yeah. Do we know if Beckham has an expiration?
Well, we really don't know the specifics.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a faction of the owners saying, yeah, we agreed to sell Beckham this team for $25 million. We didn't agree to sell this billionaire from Los Angeles a team for $25 million. We need, you know, this is not sitting with us right to have this guy come in as the majority owner and get Beckham's deal. So that appears to be part of the tension. Whether or not that's been resolved, we don't know.
So there may be some, with this switch up in investors in the possible Miami Major League Soccer team, there could be some local money now here.
Yeah, there must be.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I mean, I don't think we even know who the majority owner is, who would be the controlling partner at this point. So, I mean, the Moss brothers are savvy, smart. They've got a lot on the line. They don't want to lose their second team. So you've got to look at their public involvement as a huge sign of encouragement because they should be able to know what's coming next.
Now, the Moss brothers, the brothers involved with Moss Tech, a big construction firm based in Coral Gables, operates globally, really. You mentioned kind of they don't want to lose out on this team. What happened with their Marlins bid, and what makes them interested in Major League Soccer?
Well, I mean, Moss emerged as, for a while, the front runner in the bid to buy the Marlins from Jeffrey Loria. In fact, he was in the owner's box or sitting behind home plate with Jeffrey Loria during the big chase to buy, but they lost out to the Jeter Group.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly they emerged as David Beckham's partners in soccer. The stadium's right by Marlins Park. I mean, it's an interesting shift.
Yeah, yeah, right. And does this play better with local officials? Does it play better at County Hall than having, you know, West Coast?
Yeah. It probably would, just like Jeb Bush would have played better than Derek Jeter with the Marlins. But, you know, for a long time now, this has really been a David Beckham problem. You know, it's not a Miami politician problem. It's not a Miami-Dade problem. It was when he lost out at Port Miami and downtown Miami. But now it's really become these guys can't get their act together.
Well, I was just going to ask, like, where's the rub here? Where's the friction? Because when this was announced back in February of 2014— David Beckham said on microphone essentially that he had a pledge from Mayor Jimenez that this stadium could be downtown and on the waterfront. Initially, that was, what, on the corner of Port Miami?
Yeah. I mean, that went well. Well, I mean, that was such a disastrous rollout.
Yeah.
Because huge expectations, you know, had the mayor up on the stage saying, here we go, Port Miami in the background of this launch. And then someone said,
literally in the background of the launch. Yeah.
Anyone check with the cruise industry?
Yeah.
They weren't happy about it and defeated it. And then it just went downhill from there.
Well, then it went from there to creating new land infill.
I mean, let's think about this. This was like within days of Museum Park opening, right? This glorious new waterfront park next to these tax-funded museums. Mm-hmm. And the Beckham people come in and say, horrible idea. No one's going to use the park. Let us build a soccer stadium here.
That's right.
All you got to do is fill in this unique waterfront slip next to the Heat Arena. What could possibly go wrong?
That's right.
I mean, it's just been...
It was to build the stadium between the AAA and where today sits the Perez Art Museum Miami and the Frost Science Museum.
Right.
And it was to
fill
in...
Taking up parkland.
Taking up parkland and filling in a old, Florida East Coast Railway boat slip, essentially, that's there.
Well, I mean, old, yeah. I mean, correct. I mean, it exists. It's used.
Right. It is used, yeah. So they were going to fill that in and build a stadium. That didn't go anywhere.
No.
Now it has moved. The discussion has moved to kind of the Little River Overtown neighborhood.
Right. There was a detour where they were going to build it next to Marlins Park, which actually was the original plan for soccer in Miami. That fell apart. So now it's private land, privately funded. They're going to pay property taxes. You remember there was a while that Alberto Carvalho got involved in the school system
district,
was going to own the soccer stadium.
That's right.
So they could avoid property taxes. But that fell apart. So here they are. I mean, sort of committed to write a huge check to build this stadium, to have concerts and soccer games there. There is some neighborhood opposition. Bruce Matheson, who's a wealthy landowner nearby, he's already sued over it. I think it's probably, you can speculate whether or not more legal challenges will come once it got into the Miami zoning process. There's definitely some things to go. But the first thing that has to happen is the owners of Major League Soccer have to agree to sell this franchise to the new owners.
Right. And to that, was just yesterday at the owners' meetings for Major League Soccer owners, they did take a step forward by kind of agreeing to this new lineup of investors in the potential Miami Beckham team.
They did. I don't know how hard of a bar that is to clear. You'll recall last summer there was a lot of press out of a Major League Soccer owner vote regarding the Beckham bid, and some people covered it as being approved, and some people covered it as this is sort of a surprise. They've appointed an ownership committee to negotiate approval with the Beckham group. Well, it turned out the second take on that was absolutely right, because 6 months later, nothing's happened.
Right.
So
we should be clear. I mean, Major League Soccer has not approved the franchise in Miami.
Uh-uh.
That has not happened.
Nope.
Maybe 2018, Doug?
If it's not 2018, it's over. I mean, you are going to see this franchise awarded in the next, I don't know, 4 to 5 months, or I predict there'll be litigation.
On the part of whom? The investor
Beckham,
group?
Beckham versus MLS.
Versus MLS. And could Beckham take this team anywhere at this point, or does it have to be Miami?
I think it always was just a franchise.
Yeah.
So, but now, to bring it to Miami.
And, you know, a couple of the things that have been consistent throughout all this volatility that you just walked us through, certainly on the location and the financing and the investment team, one thing that's been consistent has been Beckham. He's always been involved in it. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's been consistent, Doug, is that they have committed to doing this stadium without public financing.
Yeah, they were forced to it because, you know, Carlos Jimenez, that's one of his major planks on all this.
Yeah.
I mean, they gave a lot away, right? I mean, when they first came in, it seemed like they wanted public land, but they would build it. And then it became, no, we'll build the land, but, you know, we want to be a tenant, so at least they don't have to pay property taxes, and they gave that away. You said Beckham's been a constant. I agree, but where is he? I mean, yeah. He hasn't been down here for a long time.
The Beckham charm offensive is what that was called back in the first quarter of 2014.
We haven't heard that
for a while. Yeah.
And then it sort of petered out.
And, of course, all this is happening in the background with Major League Soccer, and you mentioned the franchise value. But U.S. national soccer really on hard times, Doug. I mean, not making the World Cup and maybe waning interest in the part of Americans when it comes to soccer at a point where the franchise is trying to put some roots down in Miami.
Yeah, but remember Hard Rock Stadium with the international soccer matches. I mean, this is such
Classico,
a soccer town.
Yeah.
Is it a major league soccer town? At some point, that will be put to the test.
Doug Hanks playing sweeper for us on this one. He's a reporter covering Miami-Dade County for a partner of the Miami Herald. Doug, always great to have you on the field. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Many thanks to all those calling and tweeting and responding on our ground source. And thanks as well for those that supported WLRN during our winter membership campaign this week. The program is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director, and WLRN's program director is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today on the Florida Roundup is Jason Sabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for calling. Thanks for supporting public media. Thanks for listening, and have a safe weekend.